This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and boy, we have a special author, one of my all-time favorites, Robin Cook. Yes, the Robin Cook. It's hard to believe he's actually here today to talk about his new book, Charlatans. I love this title. Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you.
It's good to have you on the show again.
Well, it's nice to be here.
This is book number 35, is that right?
Isn't that amazing? It shocks me every time when I look at the list. I never expected to write one book, much less 35.
I should say this is out from Putnam. I didn't mention Putnam. Putnam has so graciously sent me a copy of it. You know, I started this book, and I just could not believe how quickly I got it. You know, with books today, you never know how fast you're going to get into a book. This book, right off the bat, there's an operation right off the bat, and it is just a phenomenal. It's like going to the Indy 500. You're just racing through this book. It is that good. I'm not just saying that. It really is true.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and it's music to my ears because you might have noticed that it's a little bit different book for me, and so I'm taking a little bit of a risk in some respects, not giving people.
Well, what made you do that?
Well, I like the continual challenge of trying to be attuned to the times, and our culture right now is in a overdrive, and in terms of changing, and I wanted a book to reflect that, and so it has to have the characters have to be up with the times, in fact, one of the characters is so into social media that that's her major social activity.
Fascinating character, I must say.
Yeah, and because these characters, I mean, these people really exist today, and some people aren't even aware of it. Facebook alone recognizes or estimates that somewhere around 10% of the profiles that they have are actually sock puppets, meaning they're totally fictitious people that have been created by other people and then manipulated, if you would, that's why they call them sock puppets, for their entertainment, and some for just fun, and other people sometimes for reasons that we might not quite understand, that nasty reasons, trolling reasons. So it's a very different world now, and it's affecting medicine as well as it is our society, and so that's why I wanted to write this book, Charlatans.
And you also have celebrities who have, like, Facebook, and you go to their Facebook thing, and you think it's really them, and you write to them, and you get a response, and then you realize, oh, it's just somebody who's looking after their Facebook page and is going to answer, like...
Well, I have to tell you that I have a Facebook page, and Robin Cook, and all those answers are all just me doing it.
Well, good for you.
I have no staff. I'm probably one of the only bestseller writers who has no staff at all. I do everything. I do all the research, because that's the fun part. Why delegate the research? Because that's the fun part. And then I do all the outlining. I do all the character development and write the whole book. No one else writes it or helps me write it.
That's amazing.
Well, you know, I feel like I have that responsibility. I approach writing the same way that I approach being a doctor. And nobody stood in my shoes when I was a doctor. People came to see me, and they got me.
How many years were you a doctor?
Well, to tell you the truth, I still think of myself more as a doctor than a writer. And I'm still on the staff. And,
oh, you are? Okay.
I'm on boards and whatnot, and I stay current. I read actually more in medicine now than when I had my private practice, with all the accoutrements of receptionist and nurse and all that kind of stuff. there you're driven by the practice in a lot of ways, and now I have more time to keep up with the medical literature, stay abreast of what's going on. In fact, I think that you might notice from my books that I'm always a little bit ahead of the curve and talking about things that are coming rather than things that have come, so to speak. I've been somewhat of a futurist, and I could give you a lot of examples of that. For instance, I wrote about Ebola back in 86, and it wasn't until, three or four years ago that the epidemic occurred.
Huh.
When I found out about Ebola in 86 or 85, I can't remember exactly when, by reading an article about this very small outbreak and then the diagnosis of what it was and the extraordinary courageous people who went into this area because it was in a small isolated hospital, I said, this is coming out of the jungle, and there's going to be an epidemic of this because it's so virile. And sure enough, 20 years or 30 years later, there was the epidemic.
All the joy and the entertainment I've gotten out of your books, I mean, it's so phenomenal. I mean, how many that I've read, I couldn't even tell you how many I've read. It's over 20, if not closer to 30, of your books that I've read. And over the years, they've provided so much entertainment. I feel like I know you. I feel like even though we've never met in person, I feel like, just from reading your books, I feel like I know a lot about you.
Well, that's not surprising, because one recurrent character, Jack Stapleton, has a lot of my characteristics, even though I was never a medical examiner. I did not study forensic pathology while I was in school or as a resident. Although to write those books, I went back and took a course in forensic pathology. So I did function as a forensic pathologist for a short time. But his interest in basketball, his riding his bike, he doesn't have a lot of patience with bureaucracy and whatnot. Those are all similar characteristics to myself.
Have you ever had anything traumatic like Noah does in this book happen to you? Have you ever had anything like that?
Well, luckily, I've had to have surgery recently. That's pretty traumatic.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
And in fact, I kind of think too bad I hadn't had surgery earlier. I would have had a lot more empathy for patients.
Well, how are you doing that right now?
Oh, terrific. I had some knee situation from my 40 years of basketball, now they're fine. So I'm back to basketball and tennis and skiing and riding my bike.
Well, what's harder, keeping up with that every day or writing a book?
Writing a book is hard work. I think that a lot of people have a misconception that they think that we writers just kind of have this sudden inspiration and idea and we just sit down and dash it off. But that's not the way it happens. It's a lot of hard work. I put in a lot of research. That's what people don't really understand, because they think, well, he's a doctor, he knows about this stuff. But each time I do a book like Charlatans, this new book, I was a surgical resident, but that was a few years ago. And I wanted to make sure that my experiences were what's going on today. So I spend a lot of time with the residents today, seeing how they function, talking to them, going on rounds, etc., and seeing that some things had changed, some things hadn't changed. The M&M conference that plays a big role in Charlatans, that hasn't changed. And the strong feelings and the anger that it evokes, and the way that the narcissistic personalities of the surgeons plays out is just the same as it was.
Well, you don't seem much like that. You seem very down to earth and very easygoing. Have you always been that way?
I don't know how I was when I was a resident. when you're a resident, especially a surgical resident, because the hours are just grueling, and they were actually worse when I was a resident. They've made some headway in realizing that probably not the best for patients or the young doctor in training to put them through such long periods of time in which they're on duty and working and not sleeping or getting an hour here, an hour there. When I was a surgical resident, I was capable of falling asleep standing up just for short two periods of time. But it was enough that it could kind of revive me in a sense. But so that's changed to some degree, and that's good.
I've often wondered what the secret with doctors is as far as distancing themselves from the patients. In other words, not getting too involved with the patients, not getting too emotionally involved. How difficult was that for you, and how difficult? What's the secret to doing that?
Well, I'm not sure that you really can or should. I mean, you can't get so emotionally involved, which is the reason that it's frowned upon to do surgery on your family members, because you want to make sure that you're not so emotionally attached or involved that you can't make appropriate decisions. But at the same time, to recognizing that you're dealing with a human being and it puts you in a very different category than most other jobs, and that's the way it should be. In fact, one of the recurrent themes of my book, of my books, is that I've really decried the close association that has occurred between business interests and medicine. I think it's been the downfall of medicine as it originated in the late 19th century, early 20th century, where it was very altruistically motivated, and now it's almost too much of a business, and that's really the problem. We all know it. I mean, the politicians, I mean, they can't solve the situation because of the business situation. It's the stakeholders in medicine are just too powerful, and they have all the politicians in their pocket, and so that's why, in a certain sense, why we have ended up with such a strange, irrational, crazy healthcare system in this country. We're the only modern industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a rational healthcare system.
Hmm.
And we suffer from it. If you look at all the gauges that are available for indicating how the healthcare system is doing for the population in general, we're nowhere near the top in any of those, any of them. And in fact, a lot of them we're near the bottom, like undeveloped countries.
Right.
But the curious thing is that we also have the best. And in fact, if you have a major medical problem, this is probably the best place in the world to be, providing you have money.
Mm-hmm.
And influence and power, and then you can deal with the system. But otherwise, it's really problematic.
Well, we start out with a patient named Bruce in the beginning of his book, and Bruce is like the ultimate nice guy. Everybody in the hospital loves him, and he goes under the knife, and you know, you have to read the book to find out what happens to him, but. But Bruce is one of those people we all seem to love. Did you know somebody named Bruce in real life? I mean,
there's always someone like that in the hospital. I mean, hospitals are little social circumstances in and of themselves, and people that work there, and there are a number of people who are just so committed to the hospital, and they work hard, and I remember when I was a surgical resident, there was a man who was in charge of parking, and which in this book, Bruce is in charge of parking. So
mm-hmm.
That's part of the reason that I'm sure that I made him do that job, because this man was an extraordinary individual, and he was really loved the hospital. He loved solving the problem of parking and was a real contribution, and everybody just thought he was terrific, and including myself. But you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because Charlatans begins with a prologue, and very often I do use that technique to get people interested in a book, and it works extremely well in the book. And why I'm bringing it up is that I'm also writing the screenplay right now for this, because I already have a major motion picture deal.
Really?
So yeah, and so I'm writing the screenplay, and my first idea when I outlined it as a book and a movie, that the prologue as presented in the book would be the way that the movie would begin. But as I started to write the screenplay, I realized that the tricks that work for the book do not work for the screenplay. As you mentioned, that you realize you get some sort of sense of this Bruce Vincent very quickly. In fact, you get a sense of all the characters in the prologue very quickly, and you know what they are like and their personalities, etc., which is what makes the prologue so moving. But if you do the same thing in a screenplay, where you just see and you can't have the benefit of the third person to be able to say what they're thinking and how they, you know, what they're...
You can't flesh out the characters like
you can't. No, it all has to come out in dialogue or visually. And there's no way for that to happen. So if you just tried to, in a movie, tried to present the prologue as I did in the book, it wouldn't work. Or if you did, you'd have to do flashbacks, and it would end up taking a third of the movie. And you can't do that, because the prologue is just really to draw you in and set the stage for the characters, the way that they're going to interact.
I can see, like, Julianne Moore playing the female in this book for some reason.
Well, you know, I used to do that when I, way back when, would envision...
Although she's probably a little too old for the character.
Yeah, well, I don't do that now. I mean, what happens in movie making is that when you're finally ready to actually go into production, then you see who's available.
Right.
So you can't sort of write something.
It's a crazy world out there in Hollywood, isn't it?
Yes, it's very difficult to deal with, and it's strange situation. I don't think there's any other industry that could maintain itself and do as well as it does, putting out so many poor products. So many movies are just really, you know, not that great. And you wonder, how are all these people out there all getting paid? And they're all getting paid too much for what we're getting out of it. I mean, there's some great movies, but there's so many that are just atrocious. And you wonder, who decided to make this movie and why? And so it's a very strange business, but I'm going to try to make Charlton's movie as good as the book. I mean, I think the book is good. And
oh, the book is amazing. I mean, it's not just good, it's tremendous.
Well, I think it might very well be my best book. It took 34 books for me to get to the point where I could write something like this, where it's very heavily character-driven story. It's very much up on the times. It's what's happening right now. In fact, I think Charlatans is anticipating there'll be a lot more books and movies, etc., about this issue, about the fact that social media and the internet is changing our culture so dramatically.
Well, it's interesting though, because when you were writing, I mean, Coma, this is the 40th anniversary of Coma.
Correct.
40, that's hard to believe, it's been 40 years. But when you were, after Coma came out, of course, there was you, but you've always, right now, you're really the only person writing medical thrillers that I can even think of anymore. I mean, Michael Palmer's not with us anymore.
Correct.
And he was, I mean, I love Michael Palmer, but he wasn't you, but he certainly had his own way of doing things, and he did write some really good books. Mm-hmm. But you're really the only medical thriller writer out there today. I mean, is there anybody else?
I don't think so. There's a number of other writers that write sort of medical themes, but
a number of people tried it, but nobody seemed to be as successful. Certainly not as successful as you've been.
Well, I think part of it is that I sort of have what motivates me is to try to enlighten the public about medical issues, biomedical issues, biotechnology, etc., so that the public can play more of a role in in their protecting themselves, because we're all patients at some point, but also hopefully to play a more active role in deciding what health policy should be. Look at this, what's happened over the last 4 or 5 months of this absolutely ridiculous situation about where they are saying they have to repeal and replace Obamacare, because the real reason they have to repeal and replace it is because of its name.
Right.
They're against it because Obama had put it out, even though the concept is actually a Republican idea. Obama took over. A Republican idea is to use private for-profit health insurance to solve the problem of access to our system.
Mm-hmm.
And Mitt Romney, as a Republican governor, was the one that really did it the first. And then Obama said, all right, it's probably the only way I can really get more people off the uninsured rolls by accepting for-profit insurance to do it. But we have to do it in this very specific way that had been decided or figured out by the Republicans. So the Republicans have been against it because Obama was getting credit, but it's the only solution using for-profit insurance companies to solve the problem.
Mm.
So there's such an interesting irony that...
life certainly has changed since Coma came out and today, today. How have you changed?
Well, I think I know a lot more about writing than I did when I wrote Coma.
I don't know. Coma's a pretty good book.
It was, but, you know, it was the kind of book that wasn't really character-driven. In other words, the same story, I could have changed the characters. Mark Bellows could have been quite different. Susan Wheeler could have been different. And they get caught up in this web of activity and coincidence and whatnot, and circumstance of the fact that there's too few organs available for transplantation, and medicine and medical science had spent all this effort increasing the efficacy of it and not thinking about the supply side. And I just realized I was doing transplant surgery myself when I wrote Coma.
Hmm.
And so I could see that, you know, the problem was just going to get worse.
But it was nonetheless a powerful book and one that I remember. You know,
of course. And you know what it did? It scared people. It was a violation of the safe haven concept, which really catches people's attention. In other words, hospitals before Coma was some place that people had in the back of their mind that they exist. If I need them, they're there, and they're going to save me. And suddenly Coma comes out, and it says, hospitals are very dangerous places.
Yeah.
And that violation of the safe haven is a very scary circumstance. And, you know, I've written my 35th book, Charlatans, is in some sense very similar, because it's violating the safe haven that we all feel that if I have a medical problem, there's always the doctors who will be able to figure it out and cure me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just like Coma made the hospital seem not that safe, reading Charlatans make you think that, hey, maybe these doctors aren't as safe as I thought.
Exactly. And now with terrorism today, we're not safe anywhere in this world.
That's right.
It doesn't even, even the school kids aren't safe in their own schools. It's terrible.
It is indeed. We live in a time in which our things are changing so rapidly, our culture's changing, and...
So over the years, what have your patients thought about your writing? I mean, they're aware that you're a best-selling author. How does that affect them when they come to you?
Originally, when I was prepared to put Coma out, which I knew was going to probably upset a lot of people, I really thought for some time whether I should put it out with a nom de plume,
right,
rather than use my own name, because I didn't have any idea of what it was going to do to my private practice. I thought, if people read this, they say they're not going to want to come to me.
So it wasn't your hope to become a writer and not be a doctor anymore?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I, I came from behind, way behind the pack, so to speak, trying to get into the writing thing. I just had something to say, something that needed to be said about medicine. That's what promoted me to become a writer in mm-hmm. the first place. But I was truly worried that it could negatively affect my surgical practice.
Did it?
No. To my shock, in fact, it went the other way. And it shows, it underlined something that I really didn't realize about our culture, is that we do live in a celebrity culture. And the fact that Colma came out and sort of myself as this unknown person suddenly produced a book and a movie that people found very interesting, and I went from being unknown to suddenly being somewhat of a celebrity. I mean, not like a movie star or anything like that, but I was on a cover article in Time magazine and all this kind of stuff. And
it was an exciting time for you.
Yes, but you know, I was pretty grounded being a physician, and it wasn't like I was going to really buy into this. I thought it more of an opportunity for me than as something that made me feel that I wasn't confident. Right, even after Colma came out, I wasn't confident.
Colma sold a ton of copies. Do you know exactly how many it sold?
The number that had been told to me was 11 million.
Wow. That's
worldwide.
Staggering.
Yeah, I know. And but...
Well, did people write to you and say, why are you scaring us like this?
Oh, yeah. I got some letters like that. In fact, I even got a few nasty letters from fellow doctors. You're scaring patients away from having surgery.
Well, you're one hell of a writer, Robin, and I am so glad you've been around for 35 books, because I so enjoy them. And, you know, and yeah, do I get scared? Of course, that's the point. But do I enjoy them more than I can even express? Yes.
Well, that's music to my ears, as I said before, but... You know, what I would appreciate even more is hearing that I had awakened some issues that you've actually thought about and changed your attitude about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the letters, I used to get a huge amount of fan mail. That has slowed down dramatically. People now respond online.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to get a huge amount. And I've gotten over the years a lot of letters from people, kids, saying they read my books, even Colma. I mean, I didn't think that it was going to be read by kids, and saying that they read my book and decided to become a doctor, and which is makes me feel fantastically good that I've influenced people to influence their career choice, especially going into something like medicine, which I still would do again if I had to do it over again.
Well, I think a lot of your characters, people feel are some kind of like role model for them, you know, that they can look up to, these people who are looking to do things the right way, who are looking to be honest and truthful to their patients and as helpful and healing as they can possibly be to their patients.
Well, I've populated with people on the other side, too.
That's true.
I mean, I wouldn't want Mason to be my doctor.
Oh, my God. Mason is he's just the most incredible guy. He can almost have his own book, the guy.
Yes, he could. And unfortunately, there's too many Masons out there.
I've assumed you've met more than your share of them.
I have indeed. The whole process of becoming a doctor, unfortunately, especially a surgeon, kind of bolsters a narcissistic attitude.
Mm-hmm.
When you're so beaten down for so long, and there's so much hazing that goes on in training, particularly surgical training, that when you finally get there, you're kind of, you don't even realize you've become somewhat of a narcissist.
I must say that the scene in this book with the guy who has that breakfast before he's, you know, he's not supposed to eat breakfast and he does, that whole thing, I've never seen anything like that in a book. I mean, I've never read anything like that in a book, and it was quite fascinating to see. I've never heard of anybody experiencing anything like that. Is that pretty common?
Thank goodness it isn't, but it does happen, and it's a good example of a little bit of knowledge can be dangerous. That individual thought he knew enough. I mean, he knew enough to say that it wasn't very... He was having spinal anesthesia, and whether he has a breakfast or not when you're having spinal anesthesia doesn't really make that much difference.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, whenever you get spinal anesthesia, there's always, you know, very mild certain risk that something is going to happen, that you're going to have to be converted to general anesthesia. And general anesthesia, for a number of reasons, can cause regurgitation, and you don't want anything in your stomach in under those circumstances. And but he thought he knew better, and he thought he knew that that it was going to not matter that he had something to eat, and he came in. He was so dedicated to the hospital. He came in at 5-something to work because someone didn't show up, and he knew he was a two-follow case and wasn't going to be operated on until mid-morning. So, you know, that's 5 hours away. Why don't I'll have something to eat? And
in the same vein, there's a lot of men out there who are afraid to go to the doctor. You know, afraid of that they're going to go to the doctor and find out something horrible, that they're dying of some disease or they have something really major. I mean, there's a genuine fear of that.
Hypochondriasis is something that I think we all feel to some degree. Medical students are probably some of the worst ones. I remember one of the things that I was for some reason particularly concerned about was malignant hypertension.
Right.
And every time I got a headache, I thought, oh my God, it's starting.
Yeah.
And
well, as a doctor, how are you as a patient?
I was, I was relatively demanding, but I think all patients are. But it was a very good experience being a patient. And in fact, I wasn't even out of the post-anesthesia recovery room before I called one of the managers of the admissions process in my own hospital, and had him come and told him that there was a problem in admissions. And, you know, if you don't go through that kind of process, running a hospital where you're taking care of people is a constant stress, in the sense that you always have to be constantly reevaluating how you're doing everything, not only for safety but just for patients' best interests. It's like a restaurant in a lot of ways. I mean, you have to constantly be reminding your employees that you're there to take care of people, and it's not just to make money or but to take care of people. And
it must be a tremendous relief watching the patients go home healthy. I mean, to know that you've done something to make their lives better. It's got to be a great feeling.
It is, and that's probably one of the biggest motivators to going into surgery versus other specialties.
And then you get to see the family, how grateful they are, and it's like a double whammy. It's like a double pleasure.
I think everybody goes into medicine with the idea that they want to cure people. One of the disappointments of going studying medicine is you realize that you don't have that many opportunities to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time you're kind of putting your finger in the dike and trying to hold back the sea and reduce symptoms but not cure. And those episodes, like when someone comes in with very toxic and very sick and abdominal pain and blah, 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 and you make the diagnosis of appendicitis, you take them up to surgery, and within 15 or 20 minutes you have this hot, red, infected appendix out on the table, and the next day the patient is completely better. I mean, it does. It gives you a fabulous feeling. And but those episodes are not as common as one would like. When
but I'm sure you've had many, many of them, enough that they've stayed with you over the years.
Oh, yes. More so when I was a general surgical resident. Ophthalmology, you know, returning someone's sight is a fabulous opportunity and sensation. Like if somebody had a terrible cataract and cataracts, and I only had one patient like that came in and couldn't count fingers, and denied that they couldn't see, and had bilateral cataracts, and it was an extraordinary situation of taking the cataracts out, and back then we didn't put in lenses, and so it wasn't until.
I didn't ask you what your specialty was.
I ended up, after doing general surgery and realizing that as much as I liked it as a resident, that it was not going to be something I wanted to do for the rest of my career, because it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job. And that's when I realized that perhaps ophthalmology might be a good idea for me, because it's surgery, and yet I could still, I knew I had other interests. Even back then, I even had political interests of thinking of trying to do something about healthcare policy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I then did another residency in ophthalmology.
Well, I want to think that the charlatans has taught me, well, if not anything else, the fact that listen to your doctor when they tell you not to eat in the morning. Don't eat in the morning.
That's for sure.
I mean, listen to that doctor. The doctor, I mean, you have to. We're at the hands of these doctors. I mean, and hopefully they know what they're doing.
Yes. Well, again, that can be a problem with the internet, and the internet provides so much information, but it might not be complete. Say if somebody realized that they knew a little bit more about spinal anesthesia and the fact that your chances of regurgitating your breakfast are pretty damn small, and besides, even if you do, it's not going to really matter too much.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like Bruce in Charlatans, decide, they tell me not to eat, but I'm going to eat or something. That is a problem. Sometimes too much information is, unless you've checked the sources and you have sort of a more complete idea of why, can be a little bit problematic.
Mm-hmm. Now you have a family. According to your preface here, this book is dedicated to your family. What do you have, brothers, sisters?
Yeah, I have both. And
do they come? Do they call you a lot and say? And tell you what their symptoms are and ask them. Do they do that a lot?
My sister is married to a doctor, so.
Oh, okay. It so runs in the family.
Several in the family. And.
But don't you get tired of that sometimes when people will call you up and tell you what their symptoms are and ask you to diagnose them over the phone? I'm sure that's happened to you.
Oh, of course. And in fact, it even happens on my fan page.
Oh, really?
To some degree. Occasionally, yeah, people will message me and give me all sorts of symptoms and ask what my opinion is and all that. But, of course, you can't really do that.
I mean, do people have this idea that if you're a doctor, you know everything about medicine?
Mm-hmm, yeah. that is... you generally have a pretty good idea about most things about medicine, especially... I feel very lucky that I did a general surgical residency, because it gave me an opportunity to actually perform so many different types of surgery. I rotated through neurosurgery, I did cardiac surgery, I did pediatrics.
You've had such a wonderful career.
Well, I've been a very lucky individual.
With medical and with writing. I mean, your writing is just, I don't know how many total books you've sold, but it's millions, I'm sure. Wikipedia
says it's 400 million.
400 million?
Yeah, that's, I don't know how they found that out.
Oh my God.
Some of the countries where I sell enormous numbers of books are really quite astounding. India is a particularly big country for me.
Do you like scaring people?
Well, to get their attention in a certain sense, realize that people like scary stuff, and
but it isn't to be detrimental in any way toward them. It's just that you enjoy the idea of scaring somebody into doing the right thing, or maybe.
Well, I think that people to keep people's interest, because you know all my books have some sort of message, not just just to be a fun book.
Right.
All of my books are based on some sort of real medical issue or biotech issue.
I remember you wrote a book one time about, said there was a disease going around the hospital and they had to figure out what it was. I love that book. I don't remember. It was a very early book, I remember. I couldn't tell you which one it was. It's hard to keep track of all the titles and what they're all about.
Well, it's hard for me.
But I love that kind of stuff. I love that kind of mystery illness kind of book. And you did it. You did it so well. I mean, other authors don't do it as well, but you certainly hit a home run on that one. You certainly hit a home run on Charlatans. I mean, Charlatans is just from beginning to end is just a wonderful read. I mean, it really is.
And it's saying something about our culture, and I think it's going to make people talk about it. And because we're all becoming charlatans to some degree. We're all having our narcissistic tendencies exacerbated by social media.
So you don't do a lot of bookstore signings anymore, do you?
I don't.
Do you miss that?
Yeah, in some respects, I enjoyed sort of interacting with fans. And
I feel privileged to be talking to you right now. I mean, I really feel privileged because you're not easy to get an interview with.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, I mean, not your everyday person could call and get an interview with you. It's not the easiest thing in the world.
Right.
But you're very, very open and very easy to talk to.
Well, you know, I feel that I appreciate the fact that people are willing to give me hours in terms of reading my books. And I appreciate people like yourself who are making an effort to promote books and promote reading.
Well, yes, reading is such a pleasure that we, you know, when you sit down and you have a book and you're really enjoying it and you don't think about any of your problems, and it's just a wonderful experience.
Well, we're becoming a culture that reads less and less books, which I feel is too bad. For the reasons that you're mentioning, and also just to be aware of issues and aware of personalities. And
are there certain of your books that have been your favorites over the years, or are they all pretty much the same? And obviously, Charlatans is one of your favorites, but
it is. And there are certain books that I remember specifically for some specific reasons.
Do you remember any that were more difficult than others to write, or are they all on the same kind of level of hardness to write?
Well, the ones where I have to do more research are probably that fall into that category. Like Cure, I really had to research a lot about Japan and the Japanese culture and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And even went to Japan. And Chromosome 6, I had to go to that area of Africa, which I don't really recommend.
It brings back memories just thinking about the title.
Chromosome 6, that experiencing that area of Africa, I think that because of that experience, I think I did my best descriptive writings. Writing in that book, where these three individuals are trying to get out to this island to see what's going on with these bonobos, and by the time they finally get out there in a small boat and are paddling up this small river, to me, I love to reread that sequence of scenes, and then where they see the first bonobo and they're afraid that the bonobo is going to be timid.
And you have to go. You have to look back on your books and think, well, how did I do all this?
I know.
How did I write 35 books? I mean, it's just, and you're not one of these writers who writes a book that. I mean, I don't remember ever reading one of your books I didn't like. I cannot remember a one that I didn't like.
Well, that's being very generous.
I can't even say that about Michael Crichton, one of the giants of this industry. I mean, did you ever get to meet him?
Oh yeah, we were quite good friends.
Really?
Yeah, we met actually while I was in the Navy, and I had read his Andromeda Strain, and
and
I knew that he had gone to medical school as well, a little bit after I. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, one day I called him up because I was doing some very interesting diving research.
Mm-hmm.
While I was in the Navy. And I called him up, and I told him who I was, and I said, you know, if you'd like to pop down here to San Diego, I'll show you our equipment and what we're doing, and which he did. And he used that information to write he did a book called Sphere.
Right.
And anyway, we got...
That's exciting.
We got to know each other a little bit. He was not he was a very smart individual, and he was not the most social individual.
Well, God, anyway, what was in that brain that came out on the page was amazing.
Yeah, and so when I wrote Coma, and then it was bought by a studio to be a movie, I actually held out for Michael Crichton to be the director. They actually wanted Brian De Palma to be the director.
Really?
Yeah, and because Brian De Palma was riding very high at that moment, higher than Michael Crichton, and in fact had done the Stephen King movie...
Carrie. Yeah.
And
what a powerful movie that was.
But, you know, I was a little bit worried because Coma... I did not want to be turned into a gothic horror movie, sort of like Carrie.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I wanted it to be a medical movie that had gothic elements.
Oh, yeah, well, I wonder what Brian De Palma would have done with that. Wow.
Yeah, so I held out for Michael Crichton and insisted and whatever and was able to carry the day, and so Michael Crichton became the director.
And then a very young Michael Douglas.
Yes.
Very cute, very, very handsome Michael Douglas, for sure.
Did you notice on my fan page at one point, I think it's still on there, is a photo of Michael Douglas and myself on the set of Coma?
No, I have to check that out. I don't think I saw that.
I think it's still on there.
So you were there for the whole experience of filming the movie?
Yes.
With Tom Selleck as the dead body? And
yeah.
I mean, why is that something? That's such a wonderful piece of trivia that people still to this day think, no way, that didn't really happen. And I think the same thing happened with Kevin Costner in The Big Chill. I think he was the dead body. He was the dead guy in the Big Chill.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think he's one of the childhood friends in The Big Chill, and you only briefly see him, which is fascinating. You know, it's one of those fascinating trivia things that you don't always hear every day, but... So what's next for you? What's book 36 going to be about? Do you have any idea?
I'm going to bring back Jack and Laurie, as you might have seen on my...
They're very popular, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very popular, and I'm going to bring them back, and it's going to be another book about... Well, we'll start out, and seemingly that it's about an epidemic.
So you pretty much know the story even as we speak?
Well, I've already basically outlined it. And
you're amazing. I mean, you're absolutely amazing. I still can't get over that number, 400 million. You're probably the most, you've probably sold more books than anybody I've ever interviewed.
Well, Yeah.
Although Sidney Sheldon might have given you a run. I did interview him once, but he, I don't know. He must have sold a lot of books. Whether he sold 400 million, I don't know. But
well, I don't know whether I sell a lot overseas, and Patterson, I'm sure, has sold a lot now because he's got such a huge team writing his books, and so he puts out so many books. And Stephen King, I'm sure, has sold a lot of books. And,
well, Stephen King's a genius.
And so
But you're the genius of the medical thriller. I mean, you really are. I mean, there's just no doubt about it.
Yeah. You know, I remember my number of years ago, I did a publicity tour in Hungary, and my Hungarian publisher told me that they were approaching 10 million in Hungary alone.
Really?
Yeah, and there's only 10 million people in the country.
So how many countries are you published in today? Do you know?
Gosh, I don't know. And in fact, we're looking into that. I have new agents, and so we're going to...
Well, you've just been a major success story overall with medicine and with writing. I mean, it's just, I'm just amazed at your accomplishments.
Well, as I've said many times, I'm a lucky boy. I started out, we lived in a very tiny apartment in Woodside, Queens, and no one in my family on either side had ever gone to college.
Wow. And, well, you changed all that.
Yeah, I was lucky because my parents moved me out of New York, that area of New York where I can remember learning how to rob from the candy store and as a kindergartner, and moved over to New Jersey into this small town that was had a lot of my friends' parents were working at either the Museum of Natural History or Columbia University. It's a very, very academic kind of town, and the school system was terrific. We didn't move there because of the school system. It just happened by luck, I think. And that changed my life.
Well, you have it good today because I'm sure you're not recognized all that much walking down the street.
No, not. Well, sometimes in Hungary I am.
Really? In Hungary, they recognize you?
Yeah, I get in the taxi cab, and the guy's looking in the mirror, and he says, "You Robin Cook?"
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing, and yet you probably could walk down the streets of the United States and not be recognized very often.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because, I don't know, people don't, I mean, maybe I would recognize you, I don't know.
Well, we're a video culture. We recognize our video stars and whatnot, and
well, the young people today, I mean, I don't know how much mail you get from younger people, although you said some of there's young people reading Coma, but a lot of younger people are, you know, off, they're reading all kinds of different things, but you know, I don't know how much they read you, but I doubt they would recognize you right away walking down the street.
No, it doesn't happen. Rarely.
So you don't have any paparazzi, like, hanging outside your house?
No, thank goodness. So that's a lot better, because I remember going out to dinner with Michael Douglas or something, and it, you know, maybe sometimes it makes you feel great or something, I don't know, but mostly it's just an imposition.
Yeah, you can only imagine what he's gone through over the years.
Yeah.
Every movement he does, you know, and that's the way it is now. I mean, if you're Britney Spears or somebody like that, good God, they follow you everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a thrill. I mean, you're absolutely amazing to talk to. You really are.
Well, thank you, David. You're amazing yourself.
I mean, you're just so easygoing and a nice guy to talk to, and you write so well. I mean, Charlatans is sure to be another bestseller, and I'm looking forward to the next book.
Well, thank you. Did you like the way the book Charlatan started? Just right the first page.
I loved it. Are you kidding me? I thought the whole thing was amazing.
Established sort of, the way I established sort of time and place, and I thought it was.
As a matter of fact, what we were going out to dinner with, I was going out to dinner with friends, and I was standing outside the restaurant reading your book. So, which is great because everybody walked by get to see your book.
Oh.
So, hopefully they all went out and bought it. But it was just wonderful to stand there and wait for my friends and read your book and have so much fun. People forget how much fun reading can be. I mean, I think a lot of people think it's work, but it really isn't work. It really just enjoyment.
Yeah.
It's really enjoyment, and for me anyway, and I hope it is for everybody else.
Yeah, well, I certainly make a big effort in that regard. That's what I'm trying to do, trying to make it...
You make it look easy.
Well,
when you come out with that many books,
yeah.
and you've been so successful, and I mean, it just seems... But it's far from easy, obviously, with all the research you say you have to do. So, I mean, research can't always be fascinating. It's sometimes got to be a little tedious, I would think.
Oh, I don't know. As I say, the research is the only fun part.
Really? Oh, yeah. For you? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you love the research.
I do.
But you don't like the editing.
No, the editing is fine. I don't actually end up. I don't have to do very much editing, because I sort of self-edit at this time. You know, I sort of, if I'm doing a scene and I can. I had this one editor years ago who had a very good sense, and when I'm writing now, she's sort of sitting on my shoulder, and I can hear her say, "All right, that's enough. You know, I got the message in this scene. Let's wrap it up."
Well, you don't need anybody doing editing the medical stuff, because you know all the medical stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
it's like if you don't know it, nobody does.
That's right.
So you don't have to worry about that. I wonder how editors do that. I mean, if you're editing a book and you know nothing about the subject matter, how do you edit that book? I mean, how do you do that?
They probably have to find someone that they trust who would have some sort of knowledge to maybe quickly read that section. Or just they feel confident about the writer, then know that it's probably okay.
Well, I look forward to seeing Jack again, Jack Stapleton. He'll be back on his bike again.
Yep.
And how many books has he been in now?
I think maybe 10 or something.
Wow,
like that.
It's that many?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, how wonderful. So it'll be good to see him back. And once again, the book is called Charlatans. It's out from Putnam and all your bookstores. Came out August 22nd. You can get it anywhere, and it is a wonderful read. You're going to love it. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.